Ever Beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, everbeyondradio.com, Tierna Sow from Ireland, Scottish Sovereigns on the Land.ning.com. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, 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 beyond. June 14th, 2015. It's been a lovely Sunday evening here in Scotland, and here down tonight I've got a UK guest. Yay, we like UK guests. A return guest, and very, very popular he's turned out to be indeed. So it's lovely to have you back. Without any further ado, we're not going to, you know, everybody knows who you are, everybody knows where you're at. Simon Parks, how are you?
Good evening, JP. I'm very well. I wish I knew where I was at. but thank you very much for that lovely introduction. Thank you.
So, yeah, well, let's just say, for the purposes of geographical locationism, I'm in the north of Scotland, so that if Britain was a body, I'd be in the head. And Simon is down in Whitby, kind of near the heart, near Liverpool, near Hartlepool. So this week, I mean, how let's just go, how have things been for you? And I've noticed that you've stopped taking any more bookings. So what's going on?
Well, a combination. We have been phenomenally busy. I don't think anybody in their wildest dreams would have imagined that my humble website and my group of volunteers would have been so inundated with genuine requests and communications. However, we suffered a energetic attack last week, and very unfortunately, one of my volunteers has decided that it was a little bit too much, the amount of work that is generated and the energetic attack. So she's left, which is really sad. Another one has decided to leave, but just to stay through, see it through until the energies return to normal and then go. And then the third one, who was the person who really set it up with me in the beginning, well, she just wants to do a very little bit. So unfortunately, the bad guys have really hammered us. And I'm going to be putting out a call, do it through a newsletter, or post something on my website saying, help. Any decent, good people out there who can help a little bit, maybe 1 hour a day, just to answer emails, update calendars, things like that. But what I would say is that clearly, whatever we had created, or whatever we have created, because it's still going, was seen as a real nuisance or a real danger to certain organizations or certain people who want to keep the status quo. So, yes, we've been tacked, and we've got an awful lot of work. So I'm just going to let it ride out, and then this week I'm going to see who can give us a hand.
Oh, right. Well, actually, I didn't actually know that that much had gone on. I knew that, I just thought you'd just gotten a bit busy and you were booked up. Okay, so, well, big call out going out. If anybody can help out, there's a lot going on, certainly in your group there.
Mm.
Yeah, indeed. Interestingly, you're talking about coming under attack. But as just a few minutes before the show started, I felt a sense of okay. I felt a sense of like a column of protection. I don't know if that was you or that your people.
What happened was I'd been just doing a few Skypes prior to the radio show, and it was dreadful. The actual quality was dreadful, and I thought, well, we're not having this for the radio show because that I need to go through properly. And so far, so good. We have a very good connection, and let's hope that that remains.
That's right. It's lovely. So, let's see how long it's going to take, or what it's going to take for them to start pulling plugs on us and sending in.
Well, last time I was on a radio show, I started to talk about Jade Helm, and the radio show had been pretty good. And as soon as they talked about Jade Helm, we were off.
I listened to that. So let's talk about some really innocent subjects, okay? Let's talk about rifts in time and space. One of the continuing threads throughout Wolf Spirit Radio. Now, you may or may not know some of the history, but I started the station with what was in effect a what they call the super soldier. His name was Dave Corso. He appeared on Jesse Ventura's show a couple of times, and that gave him a little bit of renown. And but anyway, so we made the station, and he revealed quite a lot about his situation because he was retired. He was 70. He knew he was away, so you know, eventually, so he and others did a lot of whistleblowing, and I'm now the guardian of those archives. They're all on the web. Before he died, he knew something was going, so he basically, you know, set us up for several years with the web space and stuff like that.
You know what, JP, it's so wonderful. There are brave people out there, no matter what threats or situations may be put their way. They still have a commitment to the human race, and you know, it's so wonderful that there are people like that. And it's wonderful that people like you do the radio show, because it gives, you know, it gives an opportunity for people who want to tell the truth to actually do so.
That's right. I have to say, you know, Dave had cojones of titanium. yeah, I'm a little more mild-mannered than that, but that's fine. So one of the things that we've been concerned with, you know, we've spoken to people, everybody knows about Andrew Bashago, who was in the Project Pegasus, and he talks about Obama. We also have had William Stillings, who's who's an actual scientist. You know, he builds things and space shuttle things and all that sort of military-industrial complex things. And he's given us some good education about time portals, what they're like, bismuth, anti-gravity, and he keeps saying, whenever I say anti-gravity, he corrects me, he says, no, gravity is a wave. Yeah, yes. I get it now. But I still use the term. So
it's understood by most people.
Exactly. So we are familiar. We've got a lot of information on the background of that, even what it's like to go in the jump room to Mars. You've heard of this jump room to Mars, haven't you?
Yes.
He describes what it feels like, and he's done it on multiple times, and they're all consistent. Multiple times of what it's like when you're in that box, and it's very weird. You know, it does weird things. You know, the floor and the walls become one, So we're kind of familiar with that, and one of the things that we've been looking at that seemed to have some kind of connection with us is the Philadelphia experiment. And I know that you've publicly stated you have had access in your years to Project Paperclip documents.
Yep.
And we know that and we also know through my reading of a certain book called Die Glocke about Project Ries, which means Project Giant in German, and which was the project which created the Wunderwaffe, the super weapon, which even now people are kind of mystified about, but I've got some clarity on it. At least there's a few things in this book that lay it out there. So Simon, what can you tell us about the Rift in Space-Time, Project Reese, Project Rainbow, and is there anything that can be done? Is there anything done about it? I mean, to me, it's quite a frightening thing to see that there's a rift in space and time. So,
okay, well,
maybe kind of give a bit of background for the people.
Sure. Well, okay, there's several questions there, so you'll have to remind me as we go through them.
Of course. Let's start off with the Reese and Project Paperclip things.
Right. Okay. Well, Reese, if I'm remembering rightly, was the seven underground bases. Does this sound right to you? Because I get very confused. The underground bases between Poland, Czechoslovakia, that was back then part of Germany. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, and specifically what they were doing was doing space-time experiments and experiments with red mercury.
Right, well, only in one of them, because most of the bases were built in soft rock, but only one of them was in a very hard rock. Now, I collect fossils and stones, so I can tell you that the ones at the Owl Mountains, or the Owl Hills, I can't remember now, was a metamorphic rock, which we would call gneiss. As used today, actually, in British coasts, and they call it rock armour. It comes mainly from Norway, and gneiss is an incredibly hard rock, which they use to lay down in front of the beaches to stop the erosion of the cliffs by the sea. So gneiss is an incredibly strong rock, which is very dense. It has two possible uses. One, when the Americans were bombing everything to bits, they provided a very strong, stable structure. And also, if you are using devices that perhaps emit high energy waves, then you want a very solid, strong rock cavity wall around you. You don't want soft, pliable sandstone. I think the other bases were built out of sandstone. The problem with all of these things, of course, is they were built with slave labour. And that was the hallmark of the Third Reich. And that means that these people weren't generally motivated in what they did, so the project was always well behind schedule. And most of the bases, bar one, were never completed. The importance about these secure bases was that they allowed for very special technologies to be moved from all over Germany and concentrated in one area. You're talking about what it was for. Well, some of it was just very basic. Some of it was for hiding munitions. Some of the jet aircraft that the Germans had been working on and were on the position of putting out into mass production were also stored there. But the reality was that an SS general called Kempler, I think it was, Hans Kempler.
Kammler,
rather. Hans Kammler.
Der Obergruppenführer. I love that word. It's just such a crazily long word.
So German. Who was in charge of some of the special projects. And Die Glocke, excuse me, Die Glocke was one of the projects that he had. I'm not saying he was solely responsible for it, but he had certain control over that. Because a number of the exotic technologies had come under his command. And indeed, it was these technologies that allowed him to do deals with the Allies as the Second World War came to an end. So, as I think I probably said with you before or other radio shows, the Germans' wonder weapon was never the V2 rocket. It was always the ability for craft to fly utilizing gravity. And it always makes me die smiling, because you buy these books in high street bookstores, which the front cover says Hitler's secret weapons, so you eagerly turn the pages only to discover they're talking about recoilless rifles, V2 rockets, and stuff like that. That was never the secret weapon. That wasn't
Simon, are you with me? Hang on while we try to get the call back. Sorry about that.
Hello.
Hello, we're back. Yes, we're back now. You were saying it was never the secret weapon.
It was never the secret weapon. And the problem for the Germans was not the fact that they didn't have the ability to use anti-gravity, we'll use that term, but they couldn't weaponize it. That was their issue. But the Der Glocker was something different. That was actually a prototype time machine. And so the experiments, interestingly, that were taking place in 1944 and 1945 mirrored very interestingly the experiments done to the USS Eldridge, which is the Philadelphia, called it the Philadelphia experiment, which I think was 1943, can't remember now, but basically they were similar in the sense that they were both attempting to look at time and see how it could work, although from the American point of view they were attempting to create radar invisibility. They I think initially they were looking for optical invisibility and radar invisibility, and then on the second, because they did two experiments, and on the second experiment with the Eldridge they said, look, we'll just go for radar invisibility, we're not bothered whether the craft can be seen by eyesight. But the Germans weren't looking for that. The Germans actually were further down the road, which you would imagine because of their experience, and they were looking at the ability to make things invisible but within time travel or hyperspace. So it was the potential for hyperspace that really turned the Germans on. So that's what was going on in those particular bases, and that's why they were built incredibly deeply. They had their own railway network and everything else that you would imagine. And of course, when the Americans discovered these bases, they were so impressed that they just basically copied them lock, stock and barrel into the United States of America, because they realized that when you had these deep underground bases, the ordinary populace had no clue as to what you were doing. And also, it couldn't be detected by cameras from aircraft flying overhead. So that was one of the many things that the Third Reich gave the United States of America, was the concept of deep underground military bases.
So, Project Risa, indeed, involved military bases. Now, from there was a book that I read called Die Glocke. I'm getting pronunciation lessons from my German girlfriend, who heard the first one that I read, and she nearly died. It's like, it's not Zeiger, it's Sieger. Oh, okay. And, you know, it's Die Glocke, not Die Glock. Okay, all right, darling. So I've had a series of instructions, and in fact, I have to characterize, because I'm reading the book out, and you know, I have to characterize, and I'm reading, like, you know, I've got a I have to have a voice for Kamala, I have a voice for Hitler, you know, I've got all these guys because they're all talking in the book, you know, it's quite crazy. And it's written from the journals of the only surviving scientist. Now, Sporenberg, who was who I call Hitler's hitman, came in and did the whole Nazi thing of wiping out every scientist that they could, just when the Allies were just arriving. But one of them hid in the secret tunnels of the ancient castle that they were working from.
That's where their HQ was.
That's right. Castle Gziag. Again, I can't even pronounce it. I think it's K-S-I-A-Z or K-Z-I-A-S. Something like that. Anyway, so Sieger, who had visited the castle as a boy, knew all the secret tunnels and taught his, like, inner circle where they all are. And when Sporenberg arrived to kill everybody, which is, that's kind of a well-known thing that they did to the people of the Bell, he was hiding in one of the tunnels. And he was later arrested by the Allies and brought over in Project Paperclip, and was there at the unveiling of the Keksberg, which we'll cover in a minute. But this whole thing all comes together. So what I'm interested in is the accidental thing that happened, which was the tear in space-time. When the Philadelphia experiment did it, it tore what apparently was a pre-existing hole that had been created by de Glocker. This is the kind of where do I get this is like the common accepted view of what the rift in space-time is all about, that it was started by de Glocker. But that eventually they did figure out how to stop the rift happening, how to kind of pull the fabric apart but not tear it and then pass through it. And that's covered in another book called Sands of Time by Sean David Morton. That's another journal of an insider. But what seems to be the it's a long preamble, Simon, sorry about this. The idea is that there was a tear in the fabric of space-time that was created by the Bell, that was exacerbated by the Philadelphia experiment. That the ship dropped through this thing, fell 20 years by 20 years by 20 years, appeared every 20 years, causing chaos everywhere. What do you know about that story?
I think it's largely true. It also means that when you can plot things like that, you can actually then intercept when something is travelling through or backwards, depending on how it's going. So, for instance, if a space vehicle was to come back in time from our perspective and then stay a day and then go forward in time, if you were to position yourself with the correct equipment, you would at certain points detect that craft for, I don't know, a nanosecond, I haven't a clue, but it would actually pass through. So it would be there. And the Americans, particularly with the German scientists from Paperclip, understood that. Now, I seem to remember a German by the name of von Neumann. I think that's right. Von Neumann had been working with the project and ended up at Montauk. And I know for a fact that when the second experiment of the Eldridge, it was the USS Eldridge, that was the ship's name, when the Eldridge made the second jump, that they were able to project or predict where it would go. And so actually lay not traps, but lay connections for it and have things ready in place for it coming through or coming back. So I haven't read the books that you've described to me, but from what you've outlined, it's correct. When you go from 0 to 60, as we say in Britain, you put your foot down on the gas, you don't bend time and gently push it. You rip it, you rush through it. And when you, in primitive equipment, God knows how many vacuum tubes they had on those ships, there must have been thousands, but when you hit it with all the power you've got, because that's what you think you're supposed to do, you accelerate the device so quickly that it punches, they say rips, I always use the word punches, but it punches through and is not controlled. And what they learned in future was to ramp up the power gradually so that you're not charging ahead. However, the experiments were curtailed simply because the danger made further experiments in the future very dangerous. In other words, they knew they were dealing with very primitive Earth equipment, and they reckoned that in 30, 40 years' time, from the late 1940s, they would have sufficient technology to be able to do this much more safely. But if they carried on in the way they were doing, they were damaging the space-time continuum to such a point that it would be like a Swiss cheese full of holes, and you'd be falling into the left, right and centre. So they actually stopped it as an experiment on the big scale, but they continued the experiments on a much smaller control scale. So from what you've described to me, I think is absolutely accurate. It just shows, this is actually linked to Tesla's technology, not Einstein. It was down to Tesla, all this work. Remember that Tesla was very active at that time. He wasn't murdered, didn't jump out of a hotel window. But the point is that they really didn't know what they were expecting. And I know for a fact that Tesla was furious because what they wanted, they pushed the experiment forward. That didn't give them the time to do all the refining, and as a result of it, lots and lots of crew members met the most horrific deaths that you could ever imagine. In fact, I wouldn't want listeners to imagine it, but these are live guinea pigs on board a ship, and either the authorities were uncaring or more likely totally oblivious to really what the potential could happen. And so it was absolutely awful. There weren't very many survivors.
I think, sadly, the powers at that time were quite excited by the idea of all the different things that have come out of that, because not only did they have invisibility cloaks, but they also had some kind of strange electromagnetic, I'm sure they thought, oh, I'll bet we could weaponize this, as they do with everything. So... Now, here's the thing. The Sands of Time, this was written from journals of the man in the middle of the U.S. secret space program.
Okay.
They were, and this is where Kamla comes in, you see, because apparently they'd captured Kamla and they had him on a volcanic island in the Arctic. A joint Russian and American enterprise where they were keeping this guy. And it was just like, I'm sure there was a Bond film. It's very Bond-like. But this guy, he's sitting in a room that has been carved out of a cave, and he's got his bookshelves up there, and he's got his gramophone, and the Russians supply him with vodka. And he's sitting there drunk every afternoon reading his Nietzsche and listening to Wagner with a tear rolling down his cheek. Your classic Nazi. The classic Nazi science. Anyway, so the character comes into this thing, and he's relatively young at this time, but he's tough as nails. And his father knew Kamla. Before the war, they were scientists and they were exchanging information. So he knew that he was doing something about time travel. But what he was trying to find out, what the American was trying to find out from Kamla, was how how it didn't rip a hole in space-time. Right. How not to rip a hole in space-time. How to reverse it. And what actually happened is that he figured it out for himself.
Good.
Because Kamla didn't actually say anything. Because I believe actually it wasn't Kamla. I think it was one of Kamla's doubles. But that's another story. But the guy figured it out. He came back. There's a big drama getting back. But he takes it back to the American project. And then he walks into this room and said, "This is going to change your life." So he flashes the card. And this is like in the late 50s, early 60s. It slashes the card, the thing opens the room, and they're in a big zone where they are testing. Now, what they're doing, they are teleporting a sensor device, a camera, recorder, temperature sensor device, one of these things, and they're teleporting it into a Russian nuclear explosion, because they're observing the expansion of whatever's going on. They're observing these expanding gases and everything. So they're teleporting this thing to the moon. They're teleporting it from the moon, because that cools it right down. They teleport it from the moon to the center of the explosion, reads the data, teleport it back to the moon, and then back to the lab.
Okay.
That was the project that they were doing.
Yep.
So they were teleporting things in the 1950s?
Well, what I would say is that that technology developed to one, again, that I'm not very happy about, because children were generally used. And this is where, some years ago, the leaks came out about part of America was going to be hit by an earthquake, and another part, maybe the East Coast, was going to be flooded. And by using this time traveling technology, which is basically an offshoot from it, they were looking at different timelines and what would potentially happen to America. And it did cause a lot of fear amongst many people who became aware of it, not actually understanding that that was one potential timeline, one potential outcome. Portal technology really has come about from two ways. It's a reinvention. It's not new. Portal technology existed at the times of Atlantis and Lumeria. There are natural portals, and there are, you know, people-made portals. So the Germans certainly were very hot on the trail of this. But when the Americans really opened up their communication with the grey race, that is also where the technology came through. And basically what happened was that the grey race would eke out bits of information, and it would be the German scientists who would then bring that to fruition. Ultimately it would be the American elite who would then see these projects into fulfillment. And one of the things, of course, that America could provide that Germany couldn't was laboratories and facilities that were not being bombed to bits. And that was the big difference, and that's why the Germans really didn't create what they potentially could have done, because the Allies were doing such a good job at disrupting all of their supplies and their facilities. So of course 10, 15, 20 years of German paperclip experiments in America were probably equal to 50 or 60 years in Germany, because they had free rein. Although I will say that when the rocket scientist was being interviewed, he actually said that he was very annoyed because the budget that he got from the Americans was much less than the budget that the Germans gave him. And I think he was telling somebody who told my mother that they were arguing over whether they could have a carpet, something on the floor, something like he wanted a carpet, and he said in the Third Reich, if he'd asked for a lovely plush carpet, he would have got a lovely plush carpet. But when, you know, he was asking the Americans, there was a big argument about it. I think he ended up with a piece of lino. But at that time, the V2 experiment had probably reached as far as it would go. So the portal technology was seen as time manipulation, energy weapons, very early stages, the 60s, late 50s, 60s, that was seen as the cutting edge. So putting something into the nuclear explosion, all I can add to that is before they teleported something further out to be cold, they had actually tried things like vats with dry ice and other devices first. So they've actually tried to super cool these very primitive sensing devices, you refer to them. They're actually orbs. They were metallic orbs, well, the ones I'm aware of were. And they tried to super cool them, and that didn't work. And so it makes perfect sense then to send something to outer space to see if that would do the same job. So although I'm not familiar with the story from the book, there are certain elements from that which I have heard from other people.
That's what I was hoping, because, like, you know, like you say, you were exposed to certain paperclip experiments and intelligence, and we're just putting, you know, I'm just paperclipping everything together. I'm just asking anybody who knows and putting all the different clues together to put some kind of picture, which is a very important, very large thing that has been hidden from us. You know, I'm very interested in uncovering all these things. So, Good. So, yeah, The Sands of Time, excellent book. I'd really recommend it. Don't buy just the first one. You have to buy the second one as well, because you will curse yourself if you don't. Because it's very fast-moving. It's very exciting. Anyway, so it goes on to describe how they set up Area 51 and all of those things as they went through. But what they discovered was that there was some kind of threat that was coming through the rift that had been made, and that they had to set up a kind of planetary defense system. So the first experiments were doing this, you know, the teleportation of the sensor, but then they developed weaponized lasers. And they developed this thing that they called in the book the Bug Zapper, which, when it was, I think, I can't remember exactly what setting it's like. If it was set from like 0 to 10 and you set it to about 2.5, you could vaporize an asteroid with that. Mm-hmm. So what the plan is that they have an array of teleport machines and array of these devices, and they, instead of sending a torpedo out, they teleport the device, it does its thing, and then they teleport it back before it gets hit. That's the idea of the planetary defense system, according to The Sands of Time. What have you heard on the other side of that? Can you fill in any of that picture?
Well, a different angle to that, actually. The issue or the problem was that mankind has been manipulated for a very long time. I was just having a chat with somebody today, not on that subject, but close enough to the subject. When you're in the Stone Age or what have you, you can't really do anything for anybody. And if you were an alien race who were trapped on this planet in a fourth dimensional form, and you wanted to get out of here, and you didn't have the ability because you couldn't at that time transfer into third dimension, and if you could, well, how on earth could you do anything with the technology of a Stone Age community? So they had to wait until the human race was at a certain point where it could be led and developed. So all things I see, all things like the Industrial Revolution, as part of a manipulation of mankind to hurry them along, to develop technologies that these particular creatures can't develop themselves. And one of the main points was to create a portal through which negative creatures could arrive. And it had to be created by creatures that were born and bred on this planet, because that's the only way these things work. And as a result of that, devices then had to be built to protect or guard these portals. And if people can think back to the Matrix series of films, I can't remember if it's the last one or the second film. But it's the one where, maybe it's the second film, I don't know, but it's the one where all the robotic creatures are coming through the tunnel. There's a hole in the roof here of Zion, and there's a device, like a robot tank, and they're firing these laser weapons and knocking these things out. And if you imagine in the film Matrix, that instead of a hole, this is actually a tunnel that allows things to come through a portal. It's not unlike that. I'm not aware of the ability to teleport something out, let it fire, and come back again, because I'm not convinced at that time the technology existed that would allow a robotic device to operate independently without a controller on Earth, unless there was a method for controlling it. Because my understanding of the back-engineered alien technology at that date, whilst very interesting, was still not proven or not tried at that level. But I may be wrong. But by and large, yes, what you've said to me just sounds pretty accurate from what I've read of documents that I would have read between about 71 and 73.
Okay, so I think now it will be something like a helium, argon, neon combination laser.
It's the weapon.
Yeah.
Well, that's primitive.
Yeah.
But yes, but that is a primitive weapon. Mm-hmm. So that would go right for the time frame.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know they've probably got something a lot. I don't always like to talk about weapons because you know. Just thinking about them is bad, you know, it takes you down a dark road, doesn't it? There's this guy Cobra has been talking about a thing called a strangelet bomb. Have you ever heard of that?
No, but maybe I know it by a different name.
Okay. Well, what are strangelets? Are quarks.
Okay.
A quark is it's more than subatomic, it's a boson, goes up, down, strangeness, charm, or something like that. They're four flavors of quark. I know, it's like this stuff they call quark now. But anyway, microparticle bombs and things like that. But that takes us down to back to Serum 525, red mercury. Have you heard of this material? What have you heard about this?
Well, first of all, the particle bombs are interesting because, I mean, I've actually heard the term particle bomb, so I wasn't familiar with Cobra's term. Yeah, you can charge particles that are so small that they will actually pass through material because they actually find a way through the molecules of that. And if you can get them then to expand slightly or to carry some sort of charge, then they can, depending on what you do, they can take out anything living. So potentially you could explode, I'm using that just that terminology, you could explode one of these weapons and you could bathe a alien craft or a particular craft in this. It would pass through the material, but not actually harm that, but it would kill anything living. So you would like if a neutron bomb is the poor person's equivalent of the particle bomb, it's the same principle. And depending on the type of force or charge you put with it, would depend on what they take out. So that's quite fascinating because I've not heard of the term, but the bomb side of it I have. Cobra is quite an interesting character. Member of my team went and he recently had a two-day retreat down in Hastings, I think, down in the south coast a few weeks back, and a member of my team went and participated as a member of the audience, and I think that was quite interesting. The red mercury I don't know a great deal about. Again, I may know it's something else. Can you just give me a little hint and I'll...
Okay, yeah. So, right. So, let's just... because let's take it back to the 1930s and let's just go way back, way back machine, back to the time travel, right? Because this is a moment which is shrouded in mystery. And this is the moment of the Vrildarman. These 7, 8, 9, 10 beautiful women with incredibly long hair that goes down to their ankles that are channeling the Aldebaranians.
Yep. I don't know about the hair going down to the ankles, but never mind.
Well, I mean, you can see photographs of several of them had hair like this. Some of them were gypsies and things like that. The only one whose name is found is Maria Orsic, and then there's others that are named. They're kind of pseudonyms. Sigrun wasn't her real name. That's one of the daughters of Odin. But what have you heard? What do you know about the real Vrildarman, Simon?
Well, it's very real, and it's ultimately very closely linked with Hitler through the Vril Society. As it followed through in, and that was why the one of the reasons actually the SS were formed. The SS were formed partly as a bodyguard separate to the SA, but they were also entrusted with guarding very much as we would assume the Knights Templars from the days of the Crusades, the same way as the Knights Templars guard and protect sacred objects. So Adolf Hitler saw his SS as Knights Templars, but from the Teutonic Order of Knights. And so that's why, I don't know, off to Tibet or anywhere else where there might be some exotic material, it was always the SS or an arm of the SS that were entrusted with guarding it. Hitler, of course, had encountered reptilians, Draconis reptilians. Hitler had encountered greys. The reptilians absolutely frightened Hitler to death, and when Hitler referred to them, he referred to them as the gods. And he used to say that the Draconis reptilians were the gods, but the Aryan race were the supermen. So I never was clear whether the hair was real, to be honest. That's why I made the joke, whether this was woven or plaited hair that these people wore. That's why I made the joke about hair down to the ankles. But yes, there was a secret society, a secret group that operated, that very effectively channeled in. And when they used to do their automatic writing, the writing was incredibly similar to some of the writing discovered from ancient Sumeria, because we have a similar Orion type link. So some of these creatures were from Orion and had the same link to the Sumerian culture as to the times of the Third Reich, and there was a definite connection going on there.
So that takes us to Aldebaran, or Aldebaran, or however you pronounce this thing. And so, yeah, apparently, well, the way I see it, I don't know if you're familiar with the film Dune. Did you see the film?
I've seen it when I was a kid.
All right. Well, do you remember the Bene Gesserit? These women, the holy women who could handle the spice thing.
Yes, I seem to remember. Well, used to think they were witches.
Yes, exactly. I would say that the Bene Gesserit and the Vril Daman were more or less the same thing, and he was alluding to it because he in the film he shaved their heads, he made the women bald.
Right.
So it was. It's a kind of, like, there's a hint, there's a nod here, there's something about the hair, folks.
Well, I always thought also, sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I always thought there was a link with a more recent film, which was The Chronicles of Riddick, because there was a religious order, I can't remember what on earth they were called, but they were male or female, and they had heads that were shaven. And I always thought that that was the same group. It was those who kept the secret knowledge, or those who communicated in a way that others couldn't. And I know your listeners are very, very well learned, and they'll know full well that any decent filmmaker gets information from left, right and centre, and they will add things, and some of the people who write the books also get information. So I absolutely agree that certain films tip the nod or tip the wink to very factual cases, but portray it in such a way as they can't be held responsible for leaking information. But those of us who have eyes to see and ears to hear, we'll actually look at that and think, well, that's too close to the truth. Somebody knows something. And then when you go and do your research, you can actually find that that particular producer or that particular author has referenced many things in their work, which time and time again pop up in the history within the alternative science, the science that we know is true but the establishment didn't look at. So whether these people have just been given this idea as a way to run a film and try and leak information out, or whether they've just heard it during a conversation between operatives and decided at some point they'll run it themselves, I don't know, but it is a way of the truth coming out. So yeah, I'm not surprised at that.
So what they, and also in the again in Die Glocke book, there's a sequence where he's the Seeger, the Rudolf Seeger is the name of the chief scientist of the project. He's like under Kammler and Bormann, and Seeger is brought to the the Brill Diamond House in Berlin. And everybody's sitting around, and you know, the Nazis are sitting there, and there's some esotericists over there, and there's some old white, you know, sort of grey white people, white haired people over there, and you know, the sort of people that you get are kind of. And here's the bit that I get, Simon, is that the New Age stuff that is going around now. I live near Findhorn, and you know, you've probably been to Exeter and Gloucester and all these various Glastonbury, sort of slightly more New Agey hippie kind of zones.
Sure.
This essentially was the same kind of soup that the Vril Dharman were coming through. It wasn't like a totalitarian Nazism that they were looking for. They were quite idealistic, and indeed Vril was the nature of the energy. And this is where I'm getting. This is the nub of this whole thing, is that the Seeger was taken to a room, and the woman who was there, the madame, kind of goes into her channeled trance and starts going, "Oh, I am Anquil," and you know, all this stuff, and as they do, and
listen, don't mock.
Sorry. But so there's this kind of big commanding voice comes out, and he's saying, "You must." How is he? So he was quizzing. He was actually speaking through this woman to Seeger, and you know, how is it going? And Seeger was saying, "Well, not very well. We tried electromagnetic discs. We can't seem to get enough charge and everything like that." And the voice says, "Ah, you must use Vril." And he says, "What? It's different on every planet. It's an unstable isotope, and it's some kind of ferrofluid, a magnetic ferrofluid." And he's going, "Oh, I don't know what the, you know." He's hearing all these words for the first time. You know, he doesn't know what magnetic ferrofluid means and all that stuff. You know, we know now, you know, but like then. So, and right at the end, as the channeling is trailing away, it's "Red Mercury" is the last thing he hears. "Red Mercury," right? And again, he's never heard of that either. You know, this is the 1940s. He was a German scientist. Yeah, you know. Anyway. So he goes back and speaks to Kamla and Bormann and Werner Eckert, who is your archetypal Dr. Strangelove, Nazi, crazy German scientist fellow. And he's the guy, he's the Mad Hatter, right? Because he's messing around with red mercury, right? So you think, you know, the Mad Hatter's mad because he uses mercury in felt making, right? So, yeah. You know, this guy is batshit mad. It's like really, really gone. But he's the guy that's developing the Wunderwaffe weapons, and the idea is that the Wunderwaffe is two things: is one is a teleport machine, and the other is what is deployed. And Eckert's working on what's deployed, and he's working on zombie bombs. He's reanimation of dead flesh. And you know, we've heard about these like Nazi German zombie science experiments and stuff, zombie bombs, and he's working with red mercury and the effects that it has on living material and all this stuff, and how it can enhance any bomb. So if you put a small regular bomb with a little bit of red mercury in it, it makes it a very, very big bomb. So the idea of the Wunderwaffe was actually to teleport a weapon of mass destruction straight to Washington without any warning.
Right. Now, when you spoke about red mercury, I don't know it as red mercury. I know it as heavy mercury.
Ah, heavy mercury.
That's the way it was written when I saw it in the 70s. First of all, the Vril Society were infiltrated. In other words, the channeled information, it was all coming from through channeling, was not what it purported to be. They believed, I don't know, I can't remember now, it's ages since I read those papers, but they believed it was not coming from Venus. They thought it was coming from Mars or one of the planets around in our solar system. The reality was that it was coming from somewhere else, and they were being manipulated. They were being given true and genuine information and scientific information, but it was seen as part of a manipulative program on what was then the fledgling Third Reich. The mercury, the heavy mercury, has a number of very useful applications, and one of them is used in the B-2 Spirit bomber. Very interesting story. A friend of mine worked in a very famous British jet engine establishment, and when the B-2 was being developed, there was a problem, and I think it, I don't know if it was the president, but certainly the top generals were going to see the very first flight of the B-2 Spirit bomber. And if it flew well, then they got as much money as they needed. And these aircraft were hugely expensive. I don't know if it was $1 billion per aircraft, but it was incredibly expensive. So they really needed the flight to go well. But they developed a problem, and they worked out that they didn't have an engine big enough to fly the B-2. And the guys at this particular engine facility in Britain said, how can this be? You've built an aircraft, you know how much it will weigh, therefore surely to goodness you've designed your engines for it. So they never really got an answer, but the request came through for two engines, or one engine, from this company. I'm not going to say who it was. It was the only company in the world who could make an engine, or had an engine powerful enough that would fit roughly and fly this B-2 bomber. So this company, of course, had big deals with the Americans, and they did it. And what people don't know is that the B-2, on its very first test flight, flew on only one engine. Well, what it transpired was that the engines that the B-2 had been designed for were accurate for an aircraft that weighed between 30% and 33% less than the declared weight, because inside the cabin of the particular early B-2s was a capsule, and in the capsule, separating the crew from the outside, were mercury. And by spinning the mercury and passing a charge through it, it reduced the weight of the B-2 between 25% and 30%, which meant that it could endure a longer flight because the weight on the fuel was much less, so it could go anywhere over the globe and drop its bombs. But the amusing thing is, of course, that that device broke down on the day or 3 weeks or so before the test flight. So therefore, the weight was the real weight of the aircraft without the exotic technology, and hence the engines that they had already designed for it couldn't fly it. So heavy mercury has got many, heavy mercury has got many applications depending how you use it. So I thought that would just be an interesting one to throw in there.
Certainly is. And so essentially, when you take mercury and you rotate it,
yep,
in counterclockwise, counter-rotating spheres, or
it is counter.
What is created is a torsion. It's like somebody taking two ends of a can, of a beer can, and twisting them in opposite directions, and that it happens to the local magnetic field,
yes,
Thus, the gravitational field. And,
but
and
unlike the Eldridge,
yes,
the crew were not shielded, and that's why the crew suffered horrendously. But it's now understood, so you can actually insulate living organisms. You can insulate the crew from the hull of the ship or wherever you're doing this to, so that it doesn't now take out organic life. If you wish to protect, so if you have a crew, you can protect it. But in those horrendous experiments that were done prior to that, of course, there was no protection. I think the only protection possibly were people down in the engine room, or right down, because of the bulkheads being a warship were quite thick, and I think some of the density of the steel, not the steel itself, but if you have steel gap, that actually reduced the waves and reflected them back. So it's an incredibly dangerous device when it's working, but it can insulate and shield.
Right. So this is, I mean, because this is an interesting, point. Okay. So in the book, Seeger and Helga Wilhelm, that was her name in the book. She turns out to be an American spy.
Right.
They both are being. They find out. It's a long story, but they find out that Sporenberg finds out that she's a spy. By which time they are both secreted in the hidden passages of the castle. Right. And. They fire up the Glock and they get in it and pop off. And then 20 years passes. And then there's what's known as the Kecksburg incident.
Yep.
Where something goes. Kind of, it has a kind of gentle. It doesn't drop out of the sky. It slowly descends from the sky. And is known as a bell-shaped object. You know?
This is one that was, I think, put on a flatbed lorry and towed away.
That's right. That's right.
It had, interestingly enough, markings engraved around the outside, which are not dissimilar to some of the markings found on some of the metal spars found at the Roswell crash.
That's interesting. Roswell crash.
Yes, because you see it's grey technology that's being used. When you I'm telling you this, it is interesting. I seem to be digressing, but I'm not. When my grandfather was Britain's representative to the United Nations, he was invited to visit Japan, and the Japanese were wanting to get into the cotton weaving industry, and they did not have the technology to build a cotton mill themselves. And people need to understand that back in the 1950s and 60s, cotton was a massive moneymaker for Great Britain. Cotton industry was huge. Anyway, he accepted the invite and he went over. And what had happened is that the Japanese had got a contract from Britain to copy a working mill, a mill that where the raw product came in and it was spun and woven and the garments came out the other end. So it was literally you take the raw material in one end and you put the nice made clothes in the lorry and off it goes. And they'd been round about 3 years before and they'd just literally copied this mill. And they built it and they wanted to show him. Anyway, he went round and he came back and he... Now, would it have been Churchill? It could possibly have been Winston Churchill on Churchill's last position as Prime Minister. Anyway, he went to the Prime Minister. My grandfather said, "You've got to stop these people," the Japanese. He said, "because... they are copying to such a colossally accurate degree that we're in real trouble." Anyway, nobody listened to my grandfather because the Japanese were paying big bucks and it went ahead. What my grandfather had seen was that the Japanese had copied right down to a plaque or a plate that was placed on one of the boilers. The boiler didn't work and it just said Platt Brothers 1899. And what my grandfather was saying was that the attention to detail was so great that they were able to copy everything. Now with the Die Glocke, things were copied even though they didn't need to be copied, because that's what you did, because you were so much into magic that you thought, well, if there are symbols that appear here or appear there, if we don't put those symbols on, maybe the thing won't work. So that is why the symbols that appeared on the Roswell crash also appear on the Glocke to some point and copied through, because I am not convinced that it is the same craft. I'm not convinced that the Glocker is the same thing that appeared 20 years later, because when the Americans took the paperclip scientists, they recreated their own Bell time machines. There was more than one. So I'm not certain as to which one that we saw at Kecksburg.
All right, so here's the thing. So the military pick up the Kecksburg Akon-shaped craft, and they take it into the air base, and they whip off the tarpaulin, and they've brought the paperclip scientist, Otto Czerny, who is the writer of these journals. He's the only surviving member of the Bell craft crew that wasn't murdered by Sporenberg, remember, 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
And he sees this thing. He was working on this thing 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
And he recognized it because he knew every inch of it.
Yeah.
So, and then they hear this big clanking sound, and the door opens, and out steps a jackboot.
Huh.
With dan dan dan. Hang on, where's my dan 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 machine? With Rudolf Seeger and his girlfriend Helga Wilhelm returned to America. Still, you know, as far as they were concerned, it was still 1943.
So, the problem I have with this is that you've actually been absolutely accurate that the device that appeared at Pittsburgh was acorn shaped, but the device that the Germans were working on was bell shaped. And the two did not look identical. That's why I've always said, ever since I saw the documents, that I, in my own mind, couldn't understand, if it was the same craft, why they were very different. And I know that there were many of these devices. Well, there was probably five or six of these devices built, and they changed the design. So, what's to stop an American device going back in time, picking up those scientists and coming back? It doesn't need to be the original Doug Locker, but it could well have been one of its descendants and used to go back in time and capture and rescue them, because you would need to set coordinates. You know, if this is the original Bell, you would need the coordinates. You would need to know where you were going. You would need to know that you were going to be accepted. You would need to know that you were going to land into a friendly, welcoming committee, and not someone that's going to shoot you. Because unless you have that knowledge, you may be going into the jaws of death. So much more likely that this was an operation from the future that went back into the past and brought them forward.
That's possible. That's possible. However, the narrative goes on, because what then happens is that the two people who step out of the Glock are then, you know, he recognizes him, and they, you know, because Otto hadn't seen him for 20 years. He had only seen him like a few hours earlier, and he'd also witnessed. And this is where it's all kind of, it doesn't kind of jibe with other narratives, unless you take into the account that there was possibly a lot of body doubles around, because this is another thing, you know, who died in the bunker, and Argentina and Father Crespi and all of that stuff. But in the narrative of Die Glocke, they go back in time. Because they've created this time, this loop, they go back in time, and he kills the scientist, the crazy scientist, Werner Eckert, just for the crack. Well, and he'd also killed Kammler. Otto had witnessed Kammler being killed by being thrown into the workings of a machine. And when I read that, I was quite surprised, because you know, I'd read the other book, and there was Kammler alive and well. So. But again, we know that about body doubles, and in the other book, he didn't actually give him any information. So it's possible that it could have been a double. So
well, I,
Anyway, so it's a grey zone, but whatever impact you might have on that to clear it up, I don't know.
Well, certainly, no pun intended, it certainly is a grey zone. You're looking at back-engineered technology from the greys, so I like the term grey zone. That I have no knowledge on. All I can be clear on is that there was more than one of those time machines, and the audience needs to understand that the original Deglocker contained the chair from a crashed alien spacecraft, which was the pilot's chair. Only the pilot's chair, when correctly wired in, is capable of time travel, or at least hyperspace. So you are limited in your experiments by the number of spacecraft that you've got, and particularly the number of chairs. In the Roswell space crash, the pilot's chair was at the back of the craft. So the joke the Americans have about being at the back of the bus, and the Americans will understand that joke, I don't think the British will, but in this case it's actually the best place to be, because the back of the bus was one of the most strongest protected areas of an alien spacecraft, and it is where the pilot, he or she, usually a female, sits. So you've got three or four downed spacecraft, you've got three or four pilot's chairs. If you can take them out relatively undamaged, then you can encase them, and you can then produce a sort of a time machine. But remember that the acorn-shaped craft was different from the Bell craft. The Germans were incredibly precise, and if their craft looked like an acorn, I'm sure they would have given it the German for acorn. But they didn't. They gave it the German for Bell. And the two craft were different. And it's interesting, in the story you talk about them going back in time, and before you told me that, JP, I said that my theories were that it had been a replica or another model of the craft that had gone back in time to Germany to fix and to gain what they had lost in the first timeline. So there is interesting some form of corroboration of a craft going back in time. So I think the jury's out on that, but I had, certainly in the documents I read, there was no talk about Kamla being murdered by a person like that.
No, but really nobody else survived from that period but this, the guy who wrote this. Anyway, aside from the weird time loop that was created by this little event of going back in time and forward in time, where do I want to take this? Because there's a lot of places that this could go. I want to go back to your answer about the channeling. Now, yep. from the perspective of the writer of the book, it was the Aldebaranians, or the Sumi, who were in touch with the Vril,
which is ancient Sumeria, hence the word Sumi.
Exactly, and so that they're a German-speaking extraterrestrial race who have a... they're divided into like their master race and their not so master race, and they even have separate planets for them.
Yes.
And so it is the most apartheid society, and it's the to me it seems to be the model of the apartheid oppressive regime that has existed on this planet since then, really, since Sumeria. So how much of that is
absolutely correct, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Absolutely right. But again, the whole point was not to enhance mankind's development and speed mankind along. It was to throw titbits towards mankind and to try and steer mankind towards a certain goal that was only beneficial to these creatures. They could only do it when mankind had reached a certain technological level that it made it worth their while to start all that activity. Because if you haven't yet got the facilities to smelt metal, certain metals, or the facilities to create silicon, then there's no point in playing your trump card, because the technology on the planet Earth isn't at that position to deliver what you're looking for. And so I've always said that we need to understand that the Roswell incident wasn't just some chance lightning strike on a spacecraft. It was planned and delivered deliberately so that advanced technologies would be seeded on the planet and there would be no kickback in terms of, you know, oh, well, you can't give all these primitive people all these wonderful technologies, you know, you don't know what they'll do with them. It was, well, you know, the spacecraft had an accident, it crashed, and all this technology was put over the planet, and up to the monkeys down there, what they do with it. So time and time again, I am aware that that the timeline of Earth has been changed and altered, not for our benefit, but for the benefit of others. And so the channeling from the Aldebaran group was simply there to push Germany down a certain route, because it was already preordained that all the best minds technologically would be in that area. And as it became very obvious that the technological minds in Germany were far outstripping anything else on the planet, so more and more off-world energy was devoted to it. And just as an aside, and that is why up to 1941, and the Germans were doing very, very well in the Second World War, and as soon as Adolf Hitler fell out with certain on-planet and off-planet groups, the assistance was taken away. And so that is one of the major reasons why Germany suddenly swung from being victorious literally overnight. And I don't care, no historian in the world can explain to me how a nation can win victory after victory after victory and then just suddenly just swap immediately over and lose. So Hitler, who was very much into demonic possession, he really had a possession himself, and he was mad keen on the Spear of Destiny. He'd seen reptilian aliens, he'd seen grey aliens, he was part of the Rothschild group, he was a Mason, he was part of the Illuminati. He had genuinely only had one testicle, because he had had one testicle removed as a pledge to the Illuminati, because he didn't have any children to give them as such. So we really have a situation where that country was ready, willing and open to be manipulated by an off-world intelligence, which is a disarticulated body. The Aldebarans didn't actually have bodies. It's very difficult for them. I have a wonderful drawing which I really treasure, which was given to me by an employee of the Rothschilds, of an Aldebaran, that came to visit this particular person. And I will describe the drawing. I have to put it on my website, actually.
Oh, please.
I must do. I'll dig it up, and if the bad guys stop attacking me long enough, I'll put it up. But it's a fascinating drawing, because it shows an entity that's neither male nor female. It's a very, very boyish, girlish type young face, but sort of squarish, very hard to describe. But you couldn't tell whether it was a male or a female, and this was the Aldebaran group. So yeah, I'm familiar with it. I don't have a lot of time for them, because they really don't like the human race very much.
Well, and this comes back to several years ago. I had a conversation with Alex Collier.
Ah, I like him.
And within that conversation, it was the nub of it. You know, I always find like the heart of the matter. There's so many levels, there's so many layers in this story of who we are and what we're here to do and all of these things. And I'm trying to find the right the right angle to take this. Into this void, maybe I think we need to take a break. Because actually, we've got another 40 minutes to go, Simon.
Oh, I'm fine. I've got some bits to eat here while we have a break.
Do you fancy some? Yeah, have one of your famed sausage rolls here. I'm going to play a song called just to keep us in the mood. Aldebaran by Enya.
Excellent.
Welcome back. That was Aldebaran by Enya. Everybody loves Enya. My guest tonight, Simon Parks. So, where I was that many years ago, Alex Collier was telling me a story about 400 years in the future. There was a situation in the local sector of the galaxy that tyranny had spread. And when they did their analysis, they discovered that the tyranny centered here, now. And so they sent people back in time to investigate and deal with the situation. How does that match up with your known reality, Simon?
Well, the tyranny wasn't just a tyranny on planet Earth. It was projected that it would spread right across, and one planet after another would become infected, and it would have a serious detrimental effect to the balance of the multiverse. So it wasn't, God bless them, because they really cared about humans and they wanted to come in and save the planet and this, that and the other. It was because this was a focal point. If it wasn't dealt with, then there could be the most incredible knock-on effect. And the tyranny that you're talking about isn't just the tyranny that we undoubtedly exist under every day here, but it was the tyranny that would be replicated and copied and would spread further out. So it was, I think it was about saying, this is where it ends, no further. And that is ultimately what I understand it to be.
Okay, so in this situation, have we completely identified exactly who all the players are on all dimensions?
No, because some of the players are so high in dimensionality that it's beyond our consciousness to comprehend it.
And that makes things complicated, doesn't it? Because you don't know what you don't know. There's even people that you don't know that you don't know.
Yeah, but that is the reality of it. Because, you know, if you think about God, or as I prefer to call it, Source or the Undying Creator, we don't understand that. But nevertheless, it exists. And it does exist for a good purpose, although the way it operates is beyond the understanding of most living creatures. So we have a clear vision of those creatures that materialize into our reality, because we either see them physically or we see them in an energy format. We also have a clear understanding of those creatures that manipulate situations on the Earth, even though we can't see them in any shape or form, but we can detect them. So for instance, the Archons are a force that does not take a body, yet they can infect people's minds. And of course, I think I possibly talked on your show, I can't remember, about Marconi, the deaths in Marconi, and how the cover story was that the guys at Marconi were working on the Stingray missile and the Star Wars. Well, they were, but the main reason was to try to come up with a electronic device that would identify Archons, or more precisely, people that were taken over by Archons. And that is why the Marconi scientists were murdered, because they successfully created a device that allowed an elite American military to detect Archon manipulation, and they did not want those scientists ever divulging anything to do with it, and that's why they were killed off. So we can't see the Archons, but we are capable of detecting them on an energy format. Now, if you go beyond that to a higher frequency, a higher dimension, you know, it would be very arrogant of me to say, oh yes, I know all the key players, because I don't. I guess if you were on a very high dimensional level, then perhaps you would. But at the moment, what I can say to you is that all the main players on the planet, the human players on the planet, are very well versed with everything from the fourth and the fifth and some from the sixth. But if you were to go higher than that, then I think we would be very hard pressed to identify them.
Okay, so...
So just Alex Collier, mm. He's dealing with people. I call them people, why not?
Mm, let's call them people, because they're, you know, yeah.
They are, in his case, because they were from the fifth dimension. Whereas the creatures, let's not call them people, the creatures that I meet are from the fourth dimension. So Alex was, who is, as far as I'm concerned, absolutely telling the truth and a very genuine person, and has paid the price. His fifth dimensional connections, but as you start to go beyond that, then you know it becomes very difficult to be even to perceive. If you're a third dimensional creature, biologically, even if you're taken out of your body and you are taken in your energy form, you can only perceive within your own holograph, your own printing. So if you're presented with something from the 8th, 9th, 10th dimension, how would you see that? Would everybody see the same thing? Might one person see a jellyfish-like creature, another person see like a diamond spinning in the air? How would we perceive that? Are there many things that we see that we don't actually interpret correctly? So there are plenty of very higher dimensional beings involved, and it is only in the fourth, fifth dimension that we are actually aware of these things in a very clear way.
And so the situation at the moment is such that this tyranny will continue, or has that been averted, or is it still uncertain?
It's still uncertain, simply because how can anybody second guess what the human consciousness will do? We know what the humans should do, and the people listening to your radio show know what should be done, but whether that will actually happen, I don't doubt that, and I've always said this, that we will be successful as a human race. By and large, a large proportion of us will actually make it through, but they don't know what condition we'll be in at the other end. And if there's a vacuum that's created in terms of a power vacuum, there's always the concern that something else will attempt to get in at that vacuum to just try and replace one tyranny with another. So the whole goal of this process is to prevent this cancer spreading right across the whole of the multiverse. And so that's why this planet now is such a focal point. I mean, for goodness sake, this planet is at the end of nowhere. We know we're not on a superhighway, we're not on a really important portal. There are portals, but they're not super important. We're just tucked away on the very edge of somewhere. But we've become the focal point because it was divined, I'm using that word deliberately, it was divined that unless a positive action was taken, there was high potentiality for a regime and a way of existing to be mirror copied right across the galaxies, and that the best way to stop it was to stop it here. However, there are, I don't know, however many billion people on the planet, and you cannot just destroy the planet, because that's quite an option, isn't it? Take the planet out, and there are no people to oppress, therefore you can't have a slave race, therefore there's no need for a master race. But you can't do that if you subscribe to the highest values. You have to say, let the people decide. Let the people decide. And that's why I, you, and so many others want human consciousness to rise, so that the people can, the vast majority of people at the moment who don't see the truth, they begin to see the truth, and with that they start to throw off the shackles of those that oppress us. And that is the way we need to do it. We need to actually ensure that as many people as possible start to wake up and say, I'm not doing that anymore, that's wrong. And I did say on another radio show, and I will just say it now, that they keep putting the prices up at the gas station. So what do people do? People are so disempowered, they all moan and groan and what have you. But if everybody stopped going to the gas station on Monday to fill up, you know what, by Tuesday the prices would be dropped. Because people, human consciousness has the most incredible power, but the whole game of the elite is to prevent people from understanding just how powerful they are. And once people understand how powerful they are, they really can change the world. John Lennon used to sing about this. He understood it, and many other people do as well, but people who tend to understand it generally end up being killed. So what I'm saying is that there are good players and bad players at every level. And, we can't just assume that one group from somewhere is good and one group from somewhere is bad. But what we can assume is the higher up the dimensional ladder you go, the more people have learnt, understood, and therefore they are of a more purer disposition. So you are unlikely to get bad guys in the 6th, 7th and 8th dimension, but you are very likely to get the bad guys in the 4th dimension and a little bit into the 5th. So Alex Collier was working with very good guys in the 5th dimension who were very keen to give him information, but unfortunately were not keen enough to protect him. And that's a great shame. And we see that time and time again, but the higher up the dimensionality you connect with, the more loving and supportive these entities are, but the less willing they are to physically get involved and help, because they have a very, very particular view about free will. And therefore, if you're being oppressed by somebody, they'll say, well, I'm not going to involve myself on that. Whereas guys from the 4th dimension who spend all their time manipulating have no qualms about getting involved and doing some pretty horrendous things. So poor Alex Collier, who had his life threatened by elite humans, and did disappear off the scene for 10 years, maybe longer. And it's amazing, actually. You watch some of the videos in the 90s of him, and he's a young man, and then there's a great gap, there's nothing, and then suddenly here he is as an older person. But that is why, because he had his life threatened when he started talking about the missing children. They didn't care about anything else, but when he talked about the missing children, that's when they drew the line. But he decided to come back, good for him, and did more conferences, and of course that's when they turned on him. I know that's a little bit off topic, but there are some posts out there that say, oh, Alex Collier was a criminal, etc., etc. No, he wasn't, actually. He was a man who was brave back in the days when, there was no internet as such in the early 90s. There was just the old VCR video cameras, and that's how many of his interviews were filmed. And he had the strength of determination to tell the truth. He's a shining example to many people, but like so many people, he obviously got the wrath of those who are elite here. When I say elite, I don't mean elite spiritually, I mean financially elite. So I'd love to meet Alex Collier. I always said I wanted to meet him, but that'll probably never happen.
One day, if I can, I want to get him on a round table. I want, like, you and Tolek and Alex Collier, and have a good old round table, sort of long day event radio connection.
Wouldn't that
thing.
Be lovely?
Wouldn't that be cool? That would be the coolest thing. Maybe. Yeah. And so.
Hey, listen, you talked about Rainbow. You mentioned Rainbow to me, didn't
Rainbow,
you?
Yeah, Project Rainbow.
That, am I right? That was to do with the spy plane, the U-2. Is that what that one is?
No, Rainbow was Philadelphia Experiment.
Well, the Eldridge. That's interesting. Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
When the documents I've seen, Rainbow didn't relate it related to the fallout of that, which was the U2, to make the U2 invisible to radar. So it had its core meaning in the Philadelphia, but it followed through to the U2. The documents I saw, my mother used to talk about Gary Powers, who was, of course, his U2 was shot down by a SAM-2 missile.
Ah, so they must have discovered the gravity generator.
Yes, of course. And it was called that, and then it was changed the name to Project... Oh, it began with a G. Oh, it'll come back.
Grudge?
No. Geronimo.
Geronimo, right.
It was Geronimo. But it was... what had happened is that the U-2 potentially could fly at 90,000 or 100,000 feet, potentially, but didn't quite need to fly that high, because at the time the ground surface-to-air missiles couldn't go above sort of 55, 60,000 feet. But then the Russians began to experiment with them, and what they were doing was looking at how they could make the U-2 appear invisible on radar, and they were using technologies that had been tried back in the late 40s, early 50s, because I think the U-2 was sort of up and running in about 57, 58 in a prototype form. But it was a big talking point in my house, actually, although we're talking, Powers was shot down in what, 63? 64, 65, something like that. Well, about 6, 7 years later, that was still a really hot topic, because there was a big debate as to how the Russians had shot down a U-2 over and above what the usual media were understanding, because couldn't understand how a craft with exotic technologies had been taken out by a missile. And it is true that the Americans refused to believe that Powers was flying at the allotted altitude and believed that he'd come down. And if your listeners are prepared to do a little bit of homework, you'll find that after his death, Powers' wife, I think it was finally awarded a medal on his behalf, and they retracted statements they'd made saying that yes, Powers actually was flying at the correct altitude, because they were so determined to protect the exotic technologies, and they couldn't allow anyone to think that it had been overcome by a basic, common, ordinary missile, that they put the story out that he was flying at the wrong altitude, etc., etc. But my understanding of the word rainbow is in direct linkage to the U-2 program.
Oh, I see. Well, you can see that the rainbow would be the invisibility cloak.
Yes.
Project overall, where they were two examples. One was a test and one was a production.
Yes.
So, well, I mean...
It's called the Dirty Bird, I think.
The Dirty Bird? Oh, what happened? Oh, of course, because they've got the red mercury in it.
Yes, it was originally, I think its nickname was the Dirty Bird, that's what they called it. But fascinating, I mean, the U2, but for boffins on your radio show who are really, really interested, what it all kicked this off was a British aircraft. Not long after the Second World War, the British created a jet aircraft called the Canberra, and it was a bomber. But the Americans immediately saw the potential for a spy plane out of it, and for the day it was massive. It was a huge jet aircraft in the days when jet aircraft were really, really tiny, and it outperformed, and although it was a bomber, it outperformed many of the early jet fighters, and they couldn't intercept it, so they would often play war games with the British, and they would fly the Canberra in at certain heights, and again and again and again they just couldn't intercept this Canberra. So the Americans actually bought it under license and produced it under license to make spy planes out of it, and that was the forerunner for the U-2. Fascinating. But there's a British technology there in the early days.
Well, and then well, you know all about the special relationship. Let's have a quick word about that, because, again, this is something that the GCHQ, something, I can't remember where I got this information from, but the GCHQ was basically spying on America, and that the NSA basically spy on Britain. because we're not allowed to spy on it ourselves. So very cleverly, we have a special relationship where we swap information. That's about true about the... is there anything else that we do? Oh, there's a sharing of technology as well in the deal, isn't there?
Well, obviously Snowden was one of the guys, but there was a woman, and I can't remember her name now, who went public with this a long time before Snowden did. And simply because... up until very recently, governments have paid lip service to the notion of law. The last few years, they actually don't give a damn about law, and they'll do what they please. But it's simply because the only reason that they've done this sharing of information is that if you want to prosecute in a court of law, you would have to say where your information came from. Now, the Americans can't say we've been spying on the American people because it violates a constitutional right. And it can't go to court. So that's the only reason. The same with Britain. You can't spy on a British person unless you have a warrant written by a judge. And of course, in all these cases, that doesn't happen. I mean, I have a family member, I have to be very careful, I can't drop anybody in it, but I have a family member who worked for what was the post office in Britain, it's called British Telecom now, and he used to go into work of a morning, and his job was just to tap telephones, and he would have a list on his desk from MI5 whose phones he had to tap. There was no court order, there was no court warrant, he didn't see any of that. It was just, this is what you have to do. So it's a farce. The only time they use a warrant is when they know they're going to take you to court. So it's been going for a very long time. And the Americans do spy on the American people, and the British do spy on the British people. And it's just incredible. I mean, some of the companies had a little bit of interesting information. Facebook. Facebook are building a drone in Britain, a very big drone. I have the location, but I'm not going to put that out over the radio. Now, why would Facebook be building a drone of the size of a small light aircraft? Some of these big corporations are hand in glove with the secret intelligence services because they're all into information gathering. That's exactly what their whole raison d'etre is, to obtain as much information about people as possible, sell it to corporations, or trade it to the security services for favours in the future. And that's literally how the world is run now. So the world is run not by politicians generally, but by corporations with a few politicians in their pocket.
Okay, so that is tyranny.
Absolutely it is.
So it's still here.
Well, it is still here.
And it could spread for 400 years.
Well, it depends on the timeline. That's why there's been... I talked about timelines earlier. That's why there has to be an involvement. Because unless you ensure that the only timeline that we run on is one that's beneficial to decent living creatures, wherever they may be, then you're not being a good guardian or a steward of what is basically a zoo. Because originally that's what planet Earth was. It was a zoo. And you have a group of advanced monkeys living on the planet who have every right to a proper life, to be treated fairly, and to have decency. And of course that's not what's occurring. So other creatures who have 12 strands of DNA and are connected to the human race have a responsibility, and I will say that they have a responsibility. They cannot walk away from the people of this planet, and that's why they're not walking away. But until recently it's been a little bit half-hearted, and then the last 4 to 5 years the involvement has ramped up and it's been much more useful. However, I will just say that for the last 6 months we've been in a stalemate, probably longer now, but in terms of the good versus the evil, and I know that's a term I don't like to use, but everyone knows what I mean, we are in a stalemate. No one side now has the upper hand, and so the negative sides are literally trying to top load situations this year, which they believe will give them back the initiative. So let's see what happens. But I'm expecting, and people who've spoken to me know that I'm expecting something this end of summer, fall period.
Yeah, I read one part of your document said... sorry, it didn't say that. It didn't say that at all. It said, I'm expecting some kind of wave, well, I'd say about a month from now. And I get the feeling, yes, and I think that wave will be on a very high dimensional frequency level that will then slowly filter down and will manifest in around mid of September. Is that a kind of general paradigm for you? Because, so, you know, I might have a headache today. I might say something snappy to somebody tomorrow. That person might get angry with me the day after. We might have a fight on Friday.
Have a busy life.
You know, that sort of thing. The way things escalate, it takes time. It takes time to filter down through the dimensions until it hits the ground. So, so that's my feeling of it, is that in July, not many people may notice it. But it will have a very slow, it's like when you put ink into a heavy water, so it slowly diffuses, a slow infusion, like tea. Yeah, like tea.
Tea.
Well, English fellows, yes.
I would say that is, of course, the positive side, but of course the negatives know exactly that and more. And so they will be seeking to preempt that with their own concoction of brew. And so I would expect something negative prior to that.
So, yeah, but, well, I mean, because what often happens is you get a wave of positivity. It's a bit like somebody very positive coming into your life, and... they're almost too positive, and they're a little bit irritating because they're striking the parts of you that are unhealed, that you can't quite cope with yet, and until you realize that that's actually genuine about them, and it's, you know, you need to deal with it on your own self, you know. But that's the way we evolve somehow. We're kind of inspired by seeing somebody get it right. We know that it can be gotten right.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. It's about modelling. That's how the human psyche works. That's how humans actually evolve, because they see something is possible, therefore they copy it. They see the potentiality and that something can be done. It's like, you know, if you want to do a good deed and you stand and you talk about the good deed, nothing really happens. But when somebody goes out and does something positive, they demonstrate that they have created something positive out of their own thought, and then others go and replicate that and copy that, and then the ball starts rolling, and that's how it works. So yes, that is one of the finest ways to teach humanity, is to lead by example.
And so to that end, there's one of the things that you're doing and the things that I'm investigating, aside from the time traveling Nazi bit, but thank you for that conversation, it was brilliant, is energy systems. You and Wynn, who was your guest on your first Connecting Consciousness show, run a business. You do some you do an admin or publicity or marketing or some part of that.
Right, I'm a fellow director.
Director, okay.
Company, and I'm the company secretary of a company that's just on the verge of up and running, and it's clean energy, looking at solar panels, wind turbines, but not those horrible, grotesque things that sit up 100-foot towers and spin around. You know, Wind refers to them as the windmills or the turbines, and these are ones that people can actually have on their roofs, actually their own houses. And the beauty of them over a solar panel is, of course, if it's windy at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're still generating electricity, whereas your solar panel obviously doesn't work. Also, we have a number of other products in the pipeline and a number of ideas. Ultimately, we wish to free the planet from this energy slavery that engulfs people. So we are doing that. Of course, the bad guys attack, just as they took last week, attacked my volunteers and made it so hard for us to keep going. So they will attack anything that could change the status quo. I'm very proud to be working with Wynn. It's a wonderful potential to change the way people see the model. In other words, you know, if you go outside your door on a bright sunny day and you feel the warm sun on your body, that's free. Nobody charged you to stand there and but experience your star, because that's what our sun is, it's our star, and to feel that heat, and you didn't pay a dollar or a pound, but you come in and it's a cold day or the evening, you put your light on, you have to pay for that. So this is the concept of free energy in the real terms of the word, and it's what Tesla had invented and got in trouble for. And I honestly, passionately believe that humans shouldn't pay for drinking water, for food, for heat, or for a roof over their head. If you want a nice flat screen television, yes, you pay for that, but you shouldn't pay for the basics. And, you know, as many off-world entities have said to me, in all seriousness, why are you paying to live on the planet you were born on? It is a concept that is totally alien to them, and I'm using that word deliberately. They cannot understand how people who are born on a planet and should be connected to the planet are actually being forced to pay for the natural resources of the planet, which belong to everybody, just so that a tiny, tiny elite of people can become absolutely staggeringly wealthy and be very greedy, 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 and throw crumbs to people. How have we let that happen? And that is the biggest question that ponders on the fifth, sixth, seventh dimension and up. How can a population of however many billions allow just 1% to rule them? And that they don't understand that. And we've got a long way to go, but I'm very proud to work with Wynn, and I will do whatever is necessary to see the project through.
Well, I'm really interested in this wind turbine. I've been raving about it to my friends. If you want to have a Scottish demonstration site, I live in a wind turbine corridor heaven. You know, just like I got a shed, which has constant wind. You know, like 340 days a year. I've always wanted to live on an energy farm where there's more energy comes out rather than goes in.
Well, we have some other products as well which are quite exciting. I will just quickly just say that one of the exciting things is being able to heat water without paying for it. I mean, that's just sounds wonderful.
That's the one. If you can make hot water, you have civilization.
Yes.
We're
hoping that that.
How hot, Simon? Well,
hot enough to have a hot tub.
Hot tub, 43 degrees. Okay, not bad. Can you get it boiling?
Well, I said to Wynn, who is actually my chairman, I said that I'm not going to endorse any publicity shots of you in a hot tub, selling the fact that you can create ready hot water for nothing. And that won't sell us anything. We'll have to put someone a little bit more pretty than you in a hot tub. But the concept is so wonderful that people can actually have hot water for maybe 9 months of the year. Britain is such a cold country that you probably wouldn't get it at, you know, November, December, January, February. But for the rest of the months of the year, we have the technology that would allow a normal household to have hot water and not pay for it. Now, you can begin to understand why the companies who have stocks and shares in energy are not happy with that.
Excellent, Simon. We've run out of time.
everybody should have this technology.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, 100%, 115, 184% agree. It's good to know that there are people who are actually doing things about the things that I want to happen, because I just want them to happen. I'm using my magical powers of manifestation. I want to see them. I demand that they exist. I want to be able to heat my house for nothing, you know, because... Come on, I do all this stuff. Anyway, listen, Simon Parks has been fascinating. Simonparks.org. He needs some administrative help if anybody's interested. Thank you very much. This has been Ever Beyond tonight. Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you. Take care.
Good night, everybody. Beyond.